Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this week's episode, I'll be covering the possible connection between abstinence education and eating disorders, and the business of being born. Also, a reading and an interview about RU46 with writer Kimmy Faxing Hemingway and the question of whether or not women are made of cardboard. All the bloggers are raving about this new song by girl genius Nellie McKay called Mother of Pearl. It's well written and has this strange, almost cabaret feel to it, but as a self-avowed feminist, I have to take issue with all the people out there saying it's so funny. After all, as McKay points out, feminists have no sense of humor.
Feminists don't have a sense of humor. Feminists just want to be alone. Feminists spread vicious lies and rumor. They have a tumor on their funny bone. They say child molestation isn't funny. Rape and degradation's just a crime.
Lighten up, ladies.
Rampant prostitution, sex for money. Can't these chicks do anything but whine? Dance break.
This ending is also funny if you're into that laughing nonsense.
That's why these feminists just need to find a man. I'm Dennis Kucinich, and I approve this message.
The song is off her upcoming album, Obligatory Villagers. She's also released a single about zombies off of it. From the blogger and writer Jennifer Block comes the news that the Ricky Lake-produced documentary The Business of Being Born is taking off in Australia, in part because it's being promoted by the What Women Want Party, which supports widespread maternity care reform. The movie indicts the U.S. system of giving birth that relies heavily on medical intervention even when it's not really necessary. I haven't seen it yet, but here's a sample from the trailer.
Everywhere else in the world, you see midwives attending 70 or 80% of all the births. And the United States stands alone.
You want to talk big lobby, big dollars, they can kind of call a lot of shots.
Accusations tonight that some hospitals are not being upfront with patients who are expecting a baby.
Cesarean is extremely doctor friendly. It's 20 minutes. And I'll be home for dinner.
Basically, what the medical profession has done is convince the vast majority of women that they don't know how to birth.
It seems reasonable to suggest that the American for-profit healthcare system would have an institutionalized preference for more expensive medical births over the cost-efficient midwife system. It's not that it's a conspiracy against women so much as just an institutional preference for the more profitable methods over the less profitable methods.
Hospitals are businesses. They want those beds filled and emptied. They don't want women hanging around in the labor room.
Technology is technology. It's not stopping. So if you're going to have good stuff, you might as well use it to get the best outcome.
Maternity care in the United States is in crisis.
People don't have the information.
Medical decisions are being made for monetary and legal reasons.
This is always a touchy subject because once you start talking about it, it seems like you're criticizing women who have had medical births, when that's not it at all. Most everyone accepts that a hefty percentage of births need to be in a hospital setting because they're risky births. But the issue is, why are so many perfectly normal births being medicalized? How much does the need for hospitals to make money off childbirth feed the beast? It seems like an interesting documentary, worth checking out at least. Part of the issue for me, and I suspect this is true for a lot of women, is that the advocates for midwifery often seem like another flavor of new-agey hippies who are dedicated to healing through herbs and crystals instead of more scientific and effective methods. And they sell natural childbirth as a mandatory Earth Mother experience, which is a powerful argument for a minority of women. But let's face it, The rest of us hear about how natural womanhood is so much better, and we imagine a life without Midol, birth control pills, and having to make our own tampons out of twigs, and we wisely reject the notion that natural is always better. But I think there's a non-crunchy, reality-based argument for why women with normal, non-troublesome pregnancies should look to midwifery instead of a more medicalized childbirth, and expense is the big one. And this documentary looks like it will focus on this aspect. Hospitals have to make money, and more intervention means more money over less intervention. Money alone seems to be enough of an argument for me, but some people like to rise above such petty concerns. So the other questions that need addressing are whether or not it's bad for baby health and maternal health to induce and perform C-sections as often as we do in this country, and whether pain interventions might have unintended negative effects. Then again, the emphasis on making women go through pain to make it seem more natural has always struck me as problematic. Usually when I hear people, barring Carole King, talking about a natural woman, I hang on to my wallet because usually what's coming next is a story about why women shouldn't have contraception or the right to their own income. But natural childbirth proponents often agree that medicalized birth helps save many lives, but it's just overused, which is a much better argument than appeals to nature. I'd like to welcome Kimmy Faxine Hemingway to the program. Kimmy was a founding editor of the literary journal Ecotone and received her MFA from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she currently teaches memoir writing and English composition. She's with us today to read an excerpt from her story, Personal Belongings, about her harrowing complications after taking the drug RU486. The story is available in the anthology Choice.
A young woman with brown hair cut to her jaw read my name aloud from a clipboard. I stood up, legs like Gumby, cinched the drawstring of my pajama bottoms tighter, and then concentrated on walking through the crowded room towards the woman who stood in front of a door marked private. The woman, whose name was Rachel, led me to a desk in a small windowless room and asked how I was feeling. She was kind and had gentle eyes. It was this that made my throat close up. I squeaked out some unrecognizable words. "It's okay," she said calmly, pushing some paperwork my way. "Have you thought about what kind of abortion you'd like to have?" I had not thought about it. I knew immediately, though, what my choice would be the morning I peed onto that pink stick and waited for the boxes to fill in. Knew that once they did, I'd finally have to act on what had always come so easily to my lips. Every woman should have the right to choose an abortion. Rachel explained that RU486 was an ideal drug to take in the early stages of pregnancy, that the success rate was higher than a traditional surgical abortion, given the fact that I was only 4 weeks pregnant. She said that many women had had positive experiences with the drug, in part because they felt it was a more private option. The fact that this drug was now a possible choice within the right to choose an abortion was a very big deal, Rachel told me. A lot of people had fought long and hard to make it safe and available. These were the words Rachel used to describe the experience of taking RU486, organic, natural, almost like miscarriage. I liked the sounds of those words. I especially liked the sound of this advice: make a ceremony out of the experience. She likened the pain of taking the drug to very strong menstrual cramps. I would bleed for 4 hours, maybe, she informed me. Then I'd be up and around in a couple of days. Or you could come back in 2 weeks and have a surgical abortion when we know the success rate increases. She paused and looked at me. Of course, this is your choice. You need to decide which option suits you the best. On the one hand, I was hard as nails, knew my choice. And on the other hand, I wanted someone else to decide, to take over, guide me. I thought of my mother and how desperately I wish I was strong enough to call her, how much I wanted her here right now. The pills seemed manageable, I reasoned, seemed better than driving back to this clinic after 2 more weeks of waiting for something to grow substantial enough to be eliminated. Seemed somehow easier than slipping my feet into stirrups and having to listen to that terrible sucking sound my friends had told me about, the moment when the vacuum enters you and does its job. I thought of the women in the waiting area, imagined recovering with them in a communal room, heating pads on our stomachs, buckets by our beds. Need to be in my home for this one, I thought. I'll take the pills, I said. I did what Rachel told me to do. I made a ceremony out of the event. I woke early, lit a candle, and tried to forgive myself for what was about to happen. It wasn't that I wanted a baby. It wanted it, even if I didn't. The body change is instantaneous. The mood shifts, the breasts swell, the uterus already beginning to expand, pushes on the bladder. I made a nest on the couch and piled pillows up, stacked toilet paper and maxi pads in the bathroom, played soft music. When the would-be father and a friend arrived for the showdown, I slipped the pills out of the small brown envelope, went to the toilet, and pushed them towards my cervix as far as they could go. Then I waited.
Thanks for your honest and, I thought, very witty contribution to the anthology despite all the trauma. Knowing what you know now, would you recommend the drug to somebody who's considering RU486?
Oh, that's a tough one. I would recommend it only under the pretense that the person considering it knows exactly what they're getting into and has a healthcare provider that they trust and gives them full disclosure on the drug and its possible effect. I think it was presented to me in such a way that it seemed impossible not to choose that option. It sounded almost, for lack of a better word, romantic. It seemed so easy, in fact, and it really wasn't. And I ended up having a lot of complications as a result of taking the drug. So I know that there's a very different protocol for RU486 in Europe, and I think that there's, as a result, more success with it. So I would say that if you trust your doctor, midwife, nurse practitioner, and you feel that you have all the information you need and have had pre-screening, then yes, I suppose it's a possible. It could be successful. For me, it wasn't.
Why do you think the practitioner was so eager to push this option on you, to romanticize it even?
I really think that there was, at the time, very little information, practical information, about how varied the experiences of many women who had taken the drug were, either because these cases, like mine, were unreported, only because the drug had been made legal and accessible somewhat recently, and so there was less direct experience with administering the drug. So I don't think that it was that I was, that the practitioner was trying to fool me or persuade me because she had some agenda necessarily. I think it sounded good to everybody.
Have you done any follow-up research on the drug and found any surprising findings about it?
Yes, I have. In the process of writing this essay, I did do pretty significant research and found that there are 7 reported deaths related to RU486, and I think 5 out of those 7 were the result of bacterial infections, you know, that women had developed. I suppose similar to the one that I did, though not as, it was certainly far more extreme. One or two of the cases were in Canada and the others in the United States, and there was one young woman by the name of Holly Peterson, whose case was pretty highly publicized and still continues to be, and perhaps put pressure on the FDA to alter the way they prescribe administration of the drug, which is now the drug is given orally and as opposed to vaginally. So, and it's possible that the reason it failed for me, or that I developed this horrific infection as a result of taking it, was because I inserted the second set of pills vaginally as opposed to taking them orally. So that's been one adjustment. And there have been a number of adjustments, but that's probably the most significant one that I'm aware of.
Getting this drug banned has been something of a hobby horse of the anti-choice movement. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a terrible idea. I think that offering the drug, that allowing women to make that choice, is just as important as allowing women to make the choice about any reproductive decision they're faced with in their lives. I think that perhaps more research should be done, we need to know more about the drug. There needs to be more careful follow-up, close follow-up with women who do take the drug. So I don't think that banning it is the answer. I just think more information is the answer.
Thanks for coming on to Reality Cast, Kimmy. If you'd like to read her story and others like it, please check out the book Choice, True Stories of Birth, Contraception, Infertility, Adoption, Single Parenthood, and Abortion. Kudos to Courtney Martin, author of Perfect Girls, Starving Daughters, who went head-to-head with Laura Ingraham on her Fox News TV show. Ingraham, of course, was engaging in some misleading anti-sex rhetoric.
And in the Impact segment tonight, a theory that puts young girls right in the middle of the culture war. Here's the argument, that getting girls to abstain from sex may actually cause them to develop eating disorders. I'm not making this up.
The good news is that at least the wingnuts are really giving up the entire lie about how abstinence is supposed to be an equal opportunity thing, and just admit up front that all the squealing about the importance of virginity until you're married is meant for girls and girls only. Gays, of course, are, to get busy exactly, never in this model as well. But what really burns me up is the way Ingraham says, getting girls to abstain, which implies that abstinence-only education works, and there's no real reason to think that. On the contrary, research repeatedly demonstrates that while telling kids not to have sex might lessen the chances they'll use protection when they do have sex, it doesn't do much for convincing kids not to have sex in the first place. Taking the entire American population into consideration, the finger-wagging about waiting until you're married has a 95% failure rate. In other words, Ingraham is too full of it to affect this skeptical pose towards anyone else's claims. Courtney Martin came on and explained the theory in perfectly rational terms, apparently too rational, because Ingraham wouldn't let her finish.
Here's what I believe. I believe we live in a culture where sort of the pop messages are sex, sex, sex everywhere. Hypersexualized messages that tell girls your body is your power. Then on the other side, we have this federally funded $1 billion so far, abstinence-only sex education, that tells girls your body is dangerous. Cut off all desires. Don't ask any questions. And my contention is, after interviewing over 100 women between the ages of 9 and 30, that we are struggling to decipher those two messages. In the real world, how do we create safe boundaries for ourselves, have authentic relationships with our bodies, when we're being told only
Courtney,
two extreme arguments?
Courtney.
Considering that Ingraham is one of the blonde, miniskirted, conserva babes who makes a living off the tension between looking like members of the sexual revolution while spouting retrograde, sex-hating rhetoric, hearing someone denounce these mixed messages is probably pretty upsetting for her. From my point of view, Martin's really got an intriguing theory here. Teenage girls do get mixed messages, being told all the time both that girls that aren't sexually available are, for lack of a better term, inferior product, but also that girls that do have sex are sluts, and like Ingraham says later in the show, bound for drugs, being used by men, misery, and probably suicide. For the record, the straight road from humping to killing yourself has exactly zero evidence behind it. These two views of what good women are supposed to be, both sexually available and sexually unavailable, don't have much in common. Except one thing. In both models, women are supposed to have this attitude of self-deprivation. Even the sexually available woman is supposed to have a head-shaking, nervous breakdown when confronted with a plateful of cookies, with all those lurking calories that could damage her value as a sex object. It's no wonder so many women latch onto the idea of control through depriving yourself of food as the common thread between these contradictory ideals. Of course, the theory doesn't have much in the way of scientific evidence behind it, but it is an intriguing hypothesis, and I could see future research examining whether or not Martin's hunch is right. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts, from an Inside Catholic ad found by the Trailer Park Feminist. This ad opens with an animation of a factory producing cardboard boxes.
If you thought there was a small chance that a baby was hidden in a box, wouldn't you treat the box as if it held a baby, just in case? So even if you think there's just a small chance that an unborn child is a baby, shouldn't you treat it as if it were, just in case? Something to think about.
And if you thought women could be compared to inanimate cardboard objects with no rights, no feelings, and no reason for existing other than to be containers, isn't it best to treat them that way? Geez, at least if you're going to claim that women are basically non-human containers, you could do us the favor and compare us to something sturdier than a friggin' cardboard box. Then again, maybe the choice of the word box to describe woman-shaped containers was not an accident. As Zuzu at Feminist said, though, someone needs an anatomy lesson. Your box is just an entry and exit point for the baby, not the storage container.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.